From the Sky News Centre at 5, ceremonies are taking place to mark the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. At Ground Zero, people have gathered to hear the now traditional reading of the names of more than 2,700 people who died there. And at the Pentagon, President Obama has laid a wreath and spoken of the spirit that would defeat terrorism.
On a day when others sought to sap our confidence, let us renew our common purpose. Let us remember how we came together as one nation, as one people, as Americans, united not only in our grief, but in our resolve to stand with one another, to stand up for the country we all love.
A man has been convicted of murdering his former boss during a hostage ordeal in South Wales. Newport Crown Court heard how Russell Carter bound Kingsley Monk with cable ties and rope before killing him last October. A long-awaited report into the demise of MG Rover has accused bosses of misleading ministers while pocketing millions as the car giant collapsed. The so-called Phoenix Four say they're victims of a witch hunt. A terror suspect has won a high court battle against the ban on him living in London. Lawyers for the British man, known as AN, said he would rather have remained at Belmarsh Prison than go to Leicester under a control order. Confusion reigns over plans for a Michael Jackson tribute concert. This month's date in Vienna has been cancelled, and there's some uncertainty about a replacement show in the UK next year. The promoter told us it was being moved to Wembley Stadium next summer, but we now hear it may be somewhere else in the UK. The Sun's showbiz editor, Gordon Smart, says it's all too confusing.
Well, it's madness, isn't it? I mean, who's going to buy a ticket where you don't know the lineup, you don't know when it's going to be, and you don't know where it's going to be? I'm not going to buy a ticket for that, and I would advise people not to either.
And two supermarkets are cutting the cost of petrol. Asda and Tesco say they're taking 2p a litre off unleaded and a penny off the price of diesel. Motoring groups have welcomed the move. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225. Or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
FM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and in the studio this week is Abdi Mohammed from Bristol's Somali Voice newspaper. Our regular old Labour political pundit and economics expert Martin Summers is here too. We'll be reviewing some of this week's news stories and talking to Abdi about Bristol's Somali community. It's September the 11th today. That's 8 years since the terrible attacks on New York and Washington. Many questions remain, not only unanswered, but unasked by the British mainstream media. Flaws in the official investigation, possible use of explosives in the collapse of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center Building 7, which collapsed even though no plane had hit it. And also whether an airliner or a missile really hit the Pentagon. But with internet films such as Loose Change, 9/11 Mysteries and Italian MEP's film with Dario Fo, Zero, the issue has been well examined in cyberspace. No, tonight we focus our attention here on an event 2 years before 9/11, 2001, the Moscow apartment bombings, which happened 10 years ago last week. They killed over 150 people in two apparently unprovoked attacks at a Russian army barracks and in a block of flats in September 1999. It's not known whether the Chechens or the Russian Secret Services planted the bombs, but the Russian war against the Chechen rebels was launched as a result. The Moscow attack has attracted very little press attention in Britain, with Marina Morris. And the benefit of 10 years hindsight, we'll be taking a close look at the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings and explain the connection with the mysterious poisoning in London with radioactive polonium in November 2006 of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko. Finally, we'll be following up a story from a fortnight ago about St. John's Conduit. This medieval water pipe runs under the pavements of Bristol, and it supplied the city centre with fresh water throughout Hitler's bombing blitz, but has stopped working for the first time in 700 years. City Council, Wessex Water, or the Church of England? Nobody seems to know whose responsibility it is. But before all that, here's our two-week Friday drive time weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures this week, nice and warm, an average 18 degrees Celsius in the daytime. Sunny both Saturday and Sunday. Next week, going down in temperature a bit, averaging 15 degrees Celsius, cloudy with a few sunny spells, with a potential rainy day on Thursday. Next weekend, that's the 19th and 20th of September, temperatures are again averaging around 15 degrees Celsius. Cloud cover and rain will be cloudy with sunny spells on Saturday, rainy early on Sunday. So definitely make the most of the weather this coming weekend, this weekend, rather than next weekend, the 19th and 20th. And that was the long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on now to our look through the week's news. And with us in the studio this week is Abdi Mohammed, who works with Bristol's Somali Voice newspaper. Welcome to Drive Time, Abdi.
Hi, thanks. Thanks.
Now, first of all, how did the Somali Voice newspaper get started?
Well, the Somali Voice newspaper got started in 2004 by Kaysa Maximed. He started it to help the Somali community with issues that they need to bring forward. It's worked out quite nice, but because it's a voluntary newspaper, it doesn't get to be brought out as much as we liked.
Well, and it's not like the Evening Post coming out every day. It's more like once a month, I understand.
Yes.
Now, what about you? What attracted you to come and help with the newspaper?
Well, I like to address issues from the Somali communities and sort of build bridges with the other communities. This was the first chance that I've had, so I don't work there full time, but I do help Mr. Kaysa Maximed with the Somali Voice, and that attracted me getting issues out for the Somali communities into the mainstream.
How about you yourself? Were you born here in the UK?
No, I come here as a very young person, about 10, 11.
And what were the circumstances around that?
We fled the war back home. My whole family come here. Six of my brothers, my mum. I've come into the UK in 1993.
Okay, we'll be talking a little bit more about that war in a minute, but we're also joined in the studio by Martin Summers. He's here too, our old Labour economics expert and pundit. But by way of introduction this week, Martin, tell us what you think about the new Labour government. Can they really take on the banks on behalf of the people before the next election, or are they going to bottle it?
This is a huge change of subject matter.
Well, I know, but it's just to introduce you.
Well,
yeah?
Clearly they're not going to. They're still enthralled to the banks, as are most political forces in this country and elsewhere. I mean, something will have to be done about it. Something probably will be done about it, but not immediately. There's just not enough new thinking about how to reform the banking system. We're still just trying to fix the old system rather than putting in place a new one.
Okay, and tell us about a little bit about your view of what's been going on in Somalia.
Well, obviously, it's hard for me to have a definitive view of what's happening in Somalia. I understand, like many countries, Somalia got into debt in the late 70s. These debts then create intolerable social pressures inside all kinds of societies. I've got in my book. On page 7, this is a book actually.
Which you've brought a copy of your book along.
I've brought a copy of my book. It's about Eastern Europe mainly, but I also covered, in 1989, debt servicing obligations represented 194.6% of export earnings for Somalia. So that was in 1989, before the conflict began, really. Their export earnings, twice their export earnings, were being spent just on servicing their debts which couldn't be paid. Now, this is not an uncommon problem in developing countries, but of course it creates intolerable social pressures inside the society. Whatever arguments and conflicts are going on are completely made worse by the fact that all of the resources are being sucked out of the society to fund the banks, who then go and do with it what they've done with it, which is throw it down the toilet.
So there is a slight connection with the banking crisis. Yeah, anyway, okay, we're also joined by Mukhtar Abdi. Mukhtar, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you tell us what your connection is with the Somali Voice newspaper?
And I've been working with Somali Voice last 5 years with KSM Maximat. And basically, I'm deputy editor of Somali Voice, basically, and second to KC, and I've been helping him since then, and all these years, basically, to launch the newspaper and also to launch the website.
Now, I know also that the Somali Voice is pretty unique. Well, it's quite interesting in that it's published both in Somali and in English in parallel. So you have English and Somali both in the same newspaper.
Absolutely, it's a bilingual newspaper. And yeah, if you read Somali, because there's a lot of Somalis who can't read Somali, especially the youngsters who are born in this country or who grew up in this country. So we say, like, you know, to reach all the Somali members and other community as well, that's the two both languages, you know, on the paper.
Can you give us also your view and insight into the conflict in Somalia? What do you think is actually going on there, and what's behind it?
And the problem in Somalia started in early 1980s, but basically the situation became worse in 1991 when the collapse of the Somali government. And since then, Somalia had suffered a lot of problems, basically. The warlords, there was a time there in Somalia was controlled by different warlords. And now in Somalia, we have quite other groups, basically, in Somalia, and the government, and you know, and the people who are against the government, basically the Islamists. We have got the pirates, you know, controlling the sea. So basically, the Somalia now, the problem has become really worse. And even the people who are living in Somalia at the moment, and it's tough time, because Somalia, in a way, is more like the country is on sanctions, basically. There's no ships can go in Somalia at the moment because of the pirates, you know, on the sea. And also, there's no, like, you know, proper airports, because the whole infrastructure collapsed in Somalia.
Okay. Martin, can you throw any light on this whole business of the pirates, particularly? I mean, who are these people? They're just freeloaders, or what may be happening there?
Sitting here, I mean, I have read Jonathan Hariri in The Independent pointing out that the Italian mafia, for example, are going into Somali waters and dropping illegal waste and things of this sort. So the whole of Somali waters has become a kind of unpoliced zone. But it's not just Somalis who are taking advantage of this. It's also Western companies are going and dumping their illegal waste and so on in the sea. I mean, what I've said at the beginning about the debt problem of Somalia is when the government collapsed. You've got it. Why does the government collapse in a country? It's because of intolerable pressures on the economy, exerted from outside, essentially. I mean, of course, you've got internal problems everywhere, but when you've got a poor country which is actually giving money away to survive, this is, as Muslims, you will know that in Islam, usury is forbidden. Yeah, you're not supposed to do this. And this is what, I mean, and we can see on a big scale now in the world what the problem is with this interest slavery which we live with. And of course, the consequences for countries like Somalia are devastating. I mean, it's probably one of the worst situations in the whole of Africa now, because of the fighting in Mogadishu after the Ethiopian invasion. I understand the Ethiopians have gone now. You'll perhaps tell me whether they're still there. Somalia seems a long way down a dark tunnel to many people in this country, but we're still linked to it, of course. We're all in one world.
Ethiopia left, but I mean, there's Amazon and African peacekeepers now in Mogadishu, and basically they control the airport and the main port. But still, there's small contention, basically, compared to Ethiopians, and they're about 7,000, 8,000, and they can't do much, basically, in the country, basically, because they can't go anywhere, because they will be attacked if they go anywhere. Mm. But, you know, having said that, basically, In terms of the sea, basically, I mean, you're right, basically. I mean, there's sort of toxic waste, people tell me, the water of Somalia. And basically, the party started with fishing. There were fish. There used to be like a Somali fisherman used to go out there. And there was like the other companies who used to fish Somalia illegally. So for them, they started like to protect the sea. To take their, you know, to take their hands basically, and to police the sea basically, and then it became out of control basically. But that's how they started. They were fishermen who been bullied on their sea, and then now, you know, you have got the main problem, and then so but the, that was the main problem of Somalia basically. It's other companies basically coming there, and now you have got NATO and Navy vessels in Somalia, you have got the European Union, you have got Pakistan, India, also African countries, and all of them there, and still, you know, the problem is still there.
Is there any end in sight? I'll leave this for you, Mukhtar, and Martin. Can you see any end in sight for the problem? And if so, you know, where might that come from?
I think I would say it has to come from, in terms of the piracy, it has to come from the Somalia. The European Union and NATO has to, they have to do a lot of consultation with the Somali community, who are like, for example, the Somali diaspora, who based in like America or Europe, and to consult with them, and also consult the people inside Somalia, and to set up the government, Somali government, and the Somali and basically police, and you know, so basically to establish and to build and to help the Somali government, and also to not only the Somali government, and but also the administrations like Somaliland, which is north, which is stable and peaceful area, and also you have got Puntland, which is northeast of Somalia. So basically, they could go to these and regions and administrations to speak to them, and build from there basically.
Because I think it's more worth mentioning exactly where Somalia is. It's on the top of the East Africa.
Known as Horn of Africa.
Sorry?
Also known as the Horn of Africa.
Oh, the Horn of Africa.
A very strategic place, of course, which is why in the 70s, Somalia and Ethiopia were being supported by the Soviet Union and by the West, and then they swapped over famously, and they had different support. So Somalia, a bit like Afghanistan, has suffered from being the place where other people go to solve their problems. So they're always sticking their finger in to try and create international geopolitics. But I wonder what either of our guests think about the Islamic Courts government, which was in power in Mogadishu at least until not long ago, which is the excuse for the Ethiopian invasion, because it seems that they had established at least some kind of order in Mogadishu, and now we're back to the warlord era as a result of this intervention. I mean, many people perhaps wouldn't. And of course, the Islamic Courts were regarded as an illegitimate regime by the US because they saw them as sort of Al Qaeda and so on and so forth. I mean, it seemed to me that they were just local forces with a local agenda, and that in actual fact, the removal of that regime or that relatively stable factor was not a positive step. But I'd like to hear what you think of that.
Yes, you said, I mean, you're quite right. I mean, the Somali Courts Union, they were, when they were there, like, in Mogadishu for like 6 months, they were there, controlling Mogadishu for 6 months. And those six months, they were the best time, the peaceful time, they ever had, the people, you know, the people in Mogadishu, and for us, since 1991. But basically, because their agenda, I don't know, and the West didn't like that, didn't like them, basically. Yeah. And America didn't like them, British didn't like them. And then they, with the help of Ethiopia, they removed them.
So why didn't they like them? It seems ridiculous that, you know, that this has been, seems to be bringing peace in Somalia, and yet the Americans and the British don't like what's going on, and so they remove them. It seems ridiculous to me.
It also means that we can hardly say this has nothing to do with us and we wash our hands of it, since we're sticking our fingers in so determinedly. I mean, we seem to know what we're doing, or we think we do.
So, yes, why do you think that that's happened? Why do you think they came in and did that? Because it does seem a little bit strange, doesn't it?
Because, like, and the Western seems that, you know, the warlords was close friend of with the like America, and, you know, and they used to
depends get, which warlords, doesn't it?
Exactly, Mogadishu.
The new warlords now are the
West friends. Yeah, absolutely. The warlords in Mogadishu before the Islamic Courts Union, they were working with Western countries, basically, in a way, and they were allied with them. And they're working with Ethiopia as well. So Ethiopia was established friends with them, each of them. But when the Islamic Courts Union came, they unified the people, they unified the city, but nobody likes them, in a way. But I don't know, maybe that's the way the world wants Somalia to keep that way.
Yeah, but Somalia does have some oil, I believe, and I think that this has something to do with this. If you have a situation where you have a failed state, and the West, because the West is now gearing itself up, Hillary Clinton's been saying, oh, we may have to go into Somalia. So you see, you create chaos, and then you say, oh, we must go there to solve the chaos. But of course, there are other motivations,
absolutely,
strategic and financial.
Absolutely. Now, as we have the Somali Voice people here as our guests this week, Marina Morris has been out and about on the streets of Bristol to find out what you know about Somalia and what you think of Bristol's Somali community.
What do you know about Somalia?
Where's Somalia? It's in Africa, East Africa. It's, the UN describe it as a post-failed state. It's ruled by tribal warlords. They've got a bit of a pirating issue. Some Islamic fundamentalists called the United Islamic Courts almost took it over, and then we made sure they didn't, which I don't know whether it's a good thing. Black Hawk Down set there. It's capitalist Mogadishu. It used to be a British colony. I don't think anybody's running the country now. As in running Somalia, I'm pretty sure that I don't think Somalians know who's running the country at the moment. I don't think it has a government, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, I think a few people will probably claim to rule the country, but I think they fight with the other people who also claim to rule the country. So I don't think it has a government, to my knowledge. But that's what I think is the situation.
Not a great deal, really. I know there's been some civil dispute in Somalia ongoing. I don't really know much about it, to be honest. I know there's a lot of refugees, I guess, in Bristol, the largest Somali community in Bristol, but as to the country itself, I don't really know much about it, to be honest.
I don't know a huge amount about it. I know that there's been an influx of Somalians living in Bristol. I know that from my point of view, they're just another people from another country. I don't know whether they undergo hardships in their country. I presume something like that's happening there for them to be coming over here, you know, with such large amounts. I do know a lot of the sort of white, local, or, I don't know, long-term English people are quite threatened by them, because you hear it from time to time, people being, they feel threatened that they're taking their jobs and that they see certain areas where they've been housed, and they seem to have massive families, you know, and so they're taking sort of lots of houses off the white people. People look at it like that. Christ, I mean, even listening to myself say that sounds terribly bigoted. But people feel threatened by their presence. I personally think, you know, that the world's one place and we should be able to come and go where we want. But it's hard. Maybe they could try and integrate themselves more into our community so they didn't feel so isolated or something like that. You know, I mean, people are just people. They should be able to come and go as they please. But unfortunately, you know, when new people move anywhere, if it's a change, people do feel threatened, you know, by it. That's about it.
I work with some Somalians, actually.
Yes.
Of Somalians in England?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, I work with them. I don't really hang around with them at all. Not really. I move around a lot, you see, so I'm not quite sure. But there are quite a few Somalians here, I must say. Uh-huh. Yeah.
On a map, I couldn't tell you where Somalia is. I don't really know that much about Somalia, to be honest. It's towards Africa, I believe. I know that there is certainly a history of conflict to some extent, and that there are refugees. That's about all I can tell you off the top of my head.
I know very little about Somalia, and the only thing I really know about it is that it's a country in Africa. I don't really have much to say about it, and thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Do you think it is right for Somali people to come here?
I think if, frankly speaking, anybody who does live in a country where they are subject to freedoms which we don't have in our own, with, you know, risks of violence of all time, and if they wish to come here and be a positive, law-abiding member of our society, I think I don't have any problem with that.
I think this is a question that applies to anyone who is actually seeking refugee, which is basically they're perfectly entitled to come here if they're seeking refuge, as long as it's monitored properly. I can't sweepingly say they're not entitled to be here, because that's entirely wrong.
If they've got a genuine reason and if they're politically persecuted, I don't have a problem with it, no.
I don't have a problem with anybody living in this country as long as they work and they pay taxes and they don't scab off our government.
I don't
care who lives here. As long as they don't try to enforce their religious views as well, because I don't think that's fair. We're essentially a Church of England country and that's how it should stay.
Do they come?
Yeah,
well, everybody comes, don't they? We've got everybody here.
No, I don't mind them being there long. They work, they try their hardest, and they get next to nothing. But they still work. I used to work down a mushroom farm, and we have loads down now. And they worked all the hours, and not a lot of money. But they still work. That's the only thing I know about them, really.
There's views of Bristolians out on the streets of the city centre earlier this week. Marina Morris was talking to them. And I'm joined by Mukhtar Abdi and Abdi Mohammed from Bristol Somali Voice newspaper. Now, what's your initial reaction to some of that? Maybe you first, Mukhtar, because we're hearing there that some English people feel threatened by Somalis and that they're having their jobs taken away. What do you think about that?
And I mean, there's quite a few Somalis in Bristol, but not as much as not. I think it's about there's only fair figures that amount of Somalis here and who are in Bristol. But I would say, I mean, they I think they blame intercession for the Somalis. Basically, I think there's we know what's happening in the economy. There's a lot of people that are feeling down, and sometimes the people just use Somalis as a scapegoat, basically.
I think it's true to say that when someone is in the position where they are having very great difficulty getting work, then they're always looking for someone to blame who they can see on the street in front of them, rather than maybe looking at the bigger picture.
Absolutely. I mean, you're right. I mean, sometimes when there's a deprived community, for example, and then you put another community on top of them, that community will feel threatened by the new arrival. So always that happens.
What are your thoughts, Martin? What do you think of the Vox Pop?
I think one of the fundamental issues, I mean, that didn't come out so much from your Vox Pops, is the allocation of council housing. And, of course, there just isn't enough social housing for everybody, yeah? There's a real problem. Poor people find it difficult to get decent housing. And this is an issue, and it's not the fault of the Somali community, it's the fault of the government for not providing sufficient housing. If you don't provide somebody with a house and they see somebody else getting that house that they would like to have, then they get upset. And that's because there isn't enough. We built our economy on this property myth that everybody is going to be a homeowner and all the rest of it. And this actually just doesn't work for about a third of the population. They end up with no or substandard housing. And you've got to address that. But nobody's going to mind sharing if everybody has sufficient. But when you have a situation where there's deprivation and people feel as if they're being hard done by, there's always a danger that it's going to spill over into this kind of attitude.
Well, I mean, you've mentioned social housing and council housing. We also have a story this week that we're going to be looking at a bit later from Mark Wright, Bristol's housing chief, and he is condemning the Conservative Party advice to delay housing developments. The advice apparently was sent, according to Mark Wright, to Conservative council leaders in a secret letter from Caroline Spelman MP, the Shadow Communities Secretary, outlining Conservative policy on housing should they win the next general election would revoke in whole or in part all regional housing development targets. So, I mean, that's not really helping the situation, is it? Because we're already in a situation where we've got 20,000 plus homeless people in Bristol on the housing list.
Yes, and of course the real key to getting out of the recession or depression or whatever it is would be to build houses. A, to put construction workers to work, and B, to provide houses for people. And then, of course, you move away from having this property market-focused economy and start building an economy based upon making real things. But we're not doing that because there's a bias in British society towards property ownership. It's what you might call the possessor principle. It's not what you do that matters, it's what you own. And we've got to get away from that towards rewarding people who work hard, but not rewarding them just for having stuff.
Yeah? Is this a bit like owning a flashier car?
Yes, it's the whole thing is it's actually rooted in the idea of owning your own home. You know, an Englishman's home is his castle and all this stuff. But it leads to all sorts of distortions in the way the economy's managed. We need to regard housing as a basic need that everybody needs to have fulfilled, not as some kind of game to be played in order to ensure pensions or increase wealth. People shouldn't be expecting to make money out of their houses. That's a distortion. They should be expecting to live in their houses.
Okay, getting back to the Vox Pops for a minute, because one of the issues that came up there was the issue of language. Mukhtar and Abdi, either of you got any views about way that maybe learning English or English people learning Somalian can help break that barrier? Because a lot of it does seem to be due to language, doesn't it?
I mean, you're right. myself, I teach my language. at the school, at the Beaker Center, as my language to the non-Somalis, basically. And there's a lot of people who come to my class, basically, to learn Somali language and culture. And also, I provide in here at the Beaker Center and Somali cultural awareness for organizations, basically. But also, I mean, there's people who are trying it. But also, I mean, for the Somali community, in terms, they, I think, a lot of people when you're in here. I mean, the Beaker Center. There's so many Somalis who come here every day to learn language and to improve their skills, basically, to get used to the life in this country, and also to integrate with the other communities in Bristol. So people do a lot, but I mean, and also, I mean, there's limited class as well. I mean, and if you go today, if you go to Loft Centers and then you want to enroll English class, it takes time. It, you know, it's not as easy as you think, but I mean, a lot of people still try to learn.
But I mean, it always is a bit of a difficult issue, isn't it? Should you be integrating or should you be keeping some of your own culture and national identity? You know, where's the balance there?
I think it's both basically. You have to keep the good bit, and also you have to live, because you have to learn, because there's a lot of things that the British society or is good at, basically, that we can learn from them, basically. And also there's a lot of things we at Smiles offer. Good things, basically, like the community, the family, the familyness, the togetherness, all these things, basically, and there's a lot of things, good qualities that we can offer, and also there's a lot of qualities we can learn from other, And
I think that it's a necessity for the Somali community living in the UK to learn the language and the culture, whether you. If you stay away from learning it, then you don't prosper. You don't progress. I mean, you come into this country to progress. So it's best that you know. It's like they say, when in Rome, So that's what the Somalis need to do.
Okay. What do you think was the one thing that could happen to really help that?
Well, there's a lot of things that are already happening at the moment with the Somalis in terms of learning the language. There is the ESOL classes. There is the local areas. For example, Barton Hill, they have classes, English classes going on there for the new Somalis coming that are in this country, and there are a lot of Somalis that are enrolled in that, which is good.
Okay, just going back before we finish to talking about some of the colonial past in Somalia, Martin, were the English involved? I think in another part of Somalia called Somaliland, which is slightly north.
Part of the British Empire, but yeah. Somalia as a whole was colonised by the Italians, I believe. And so there's no point people in the West saying this, the problems in Somalia, nothing to do with us. I mean, we've been working together or fighting or living together for generations, and so we've got to get on a more positive foot both here and in Somalia itself. Let's hope peace comes to Somalia. This is what we would all wish to happen, and for the society to be rebuilt. But what the danger with Somalia at the moment is, it's going to be named as another place where the West wants to intervene directly, like in Afghanistan. And I think we must resist that. I can't see that will solve the problems. I don't know what our guess is.
Yeah, let's have an answer on that question from you, Mukhtar and Abdi.
And for going in, I think that will make the problem more worse, basically. And I think they should let Somalis deal with themselves, because we know the experience from what has happened in Iraq, we know what's happening in Afghanistan, and and there's a lot of refugees. Like, there's now millions of Iraqis who live in Syria and other places as a result of the invasion. And also, we know that what's going on in Afghanistan, every day, British soldiers losing their lives, also the Afghans losing their lives in both sides, basically, which is no good for both of them. And basically, and I think Somalia is going to be, if they. The West go to Somalia and invade Somalia or send troops to Somalia, I think they will make it more worse, and I think that will spill the problem even to other countries like Kenya and Ethiopia and Djibouti, and Somalia will become a hub for all the international fighters, like jihadists, what you call it, and a lot of, it will be a base for a lot of, and that's.
But realistically, can the Somalis sort out their own government? Because there's obviously other people who are sticking their fingers in at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, the Somalis, what you've got now is like you have got neighboring countries. You have got like Ethiopia and Kenya and African countries who are mingling with the Somali stuff basically and supported by Western countries. So it's still, there's, you know, there's a, they put their hands, but they haven't sent any troops yet, but it's still you have got their hands on there.
I mean, we spoke earlier about the overthrow of the Somali courts government. It wasn't a government really, it was an attempt to try and bring order within Mogadishu at least, and the West sabotaged that. So I don't think we can say that the West's intervention has been in any way benign. You know, there was an opportunity for things to start to improve, and the West sabotaged it. So when people say, why are the Somali people in Britain? That's because we are creating situation for them to be here. So let's solve all these problems.
Yeah, so Mukhtar and Abdi, I'd like to give you a last word on the Somali issue. Can we have just what your views are on the way to peace?
Well, I think the way to peace is for... which is a very hard thing for all sides, to be honest, and for all sides to be to want to progress. The general public of Somalia want peace. They are tired of fighting. They are tired of fleeing the war and having deaths and seeing blood and all of this. But there are a few people who are dishonest, and they're the one that are affecting these people a lot. And I don't just mean the West. I mean within the Somalis as well, and that needs to be sorted out. And those people need to be got rid of for it to move forward. And the general public's voice needs to come out.
I think it's a difficult question, but I mean, I would say that we should give a chance, support the administration, like Somalia, the place like Somalia and Puntland, and other regions basically who are stable. Mm-hmm. And then we can start them from there basically. So let's not concentrate on just in Mogadishu. Okay, there's a problem in Mogadishu, there's a curse in Mogadishu, but what about the other parts of the country? What about, the southeast, the southwest, basically, and northern part of Somalia, the eastern part of Somalia? We can, you know, help those regions, basically, to build some kind of administration, and then that would be easy, I think. You have to break it slice by slice, basically, break it down. And then help like Somaliland, because Somaliland has stable governments for last, how many years, 18 years? And also Puntland region as well. So we should support these regions basically, and administrations. And then we can then focus on Mogadishu at the end then.
Okay, well, Mukhtar Abdi and Abdi Mohammed from Bristol's Somali Voice newspaper, monthly. And can you just tell us when is the next edition coming out? Because I know you had, about 2 months ago, you had a firebomb attack on the office in Easton. So when's the next edition going to be hitting the streets?
Well, the next publication will be in October. There was an attack in the Somali Voice office in Easton. The police are still investigating it. We won't like to point any fingers because, you know, we don't know, and we leave it to the police. We have a new place in St. Agnes in Balls. St. Agnes' place, which we'll be opening in on the 25th of this month. And we'd like to thank the Avon and Somerset Police, as well as the Bristol City Council, as well as many other organisations, including SARI. And that should be coming out in October. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Also, we'd like to thank Frontdoor as well for helping us, because they provide us computers and, you know, some basic stuff basically. So we'd like to thank them, Frontdoor as well.
Well, that's great news. You're back on your feet again. So we look forward to that a controversial newspaper hitting the streets in around about October.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
10 years ago last week, in September 1999, in Moscow, two shocking and apparently motiveless bombings came out of the blue to kill over 150 Russians. A bloody war and Russian occupation of Chechnya was launched as a result. These seemingly unprovoked bomb attacks took place at a Russian army barracks on the 4th of September and in a Moscow block of flats on the 9th of September 1999. 64 Russian soldiers and family members were killed in the first attack, and 94 innocent people were killed while they were asleep at home in their beds in the second. With Marina Morris and the benefit of 10 years hindsight, we'll be taking a close look now at the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings with our pundit, also Oxford PPE graduate Martin Summers. First of all, though, Marina Morris reports on what is probably the most shocking episode in contemporary Russian history.
Yes. 10 years ago, between the 8th and 16th September 1999, three terrorist acts occurred in Russia. Two in the Russian capital Moscow and the third in Volgodonsk, near Chechnya. As a result of these attacks, 307 people were killed and more than 1,700 people were injured. The first explosion occurred 2 seconds before midnight on the night between 8th and 9th September on the ground floor of the 8th floor apartment in the southeast of Moscow. The explosion was so big that nearby buildings were also significantly damaged. Official data shows that 100 people died and 690 people were injured by this incident. The explosive power was equivalent to between 300 and 400 kilograms of TNT, a high explosive. The next explosion occurred on the night of the 12th and 13th September in the cellar of the 8-story house on the highway Kashirskaya, south of the central Moscow. This explosion was equivalent to more than 200 kilograms of TNT and as a result reduced the apartments to ruins. 118 of the 150 occupants of the building were killed. On the 16th of September in Volgodonsk, a lorry carrying explosives was detonated near the to a 9-floor apartment. The front part of the apartment was destroyed and 37 neighboring buildings were damaged. 90 people were killed and 89 others were hospitalized. The official version of this explosion was that they were perpetrated by Northern Caucasian extremists. The verdict of Russian court are that these acts of terrorism were organized and financed by the head of the illegal armed organization, the Islamic Institute of Kafkas, who had close connections with a terrorist Osama bin Laden, amongst others. Bin Laden at the time was linked to terrorist explosion in the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 and subsequently 9/11 in 2001. Most Russians believe this explanation. There are always alternative interpretations. One conspiracy theory is that Vladimir Putin might have been involved with a secret plot to bomb these apartments to influence public opinion prior to the Russian involvement in the Chechnya Republic and to increase his popularity before presidential election. The latest opinion poll from the Russian Central Institute of Public Opinion is that 57% of Russians can't believe that the Russian Secret Service could have been involved. 22% believe that there might be some truth in this. According to the latest poll of the world political leader, 82% of Russians trust Mr. Putin. The American magazine GQ recently published an article, none dare call it conspiracy, expounding the above conspiracy theory about Putin's involvement. 10 years on, belief in a conspiracy is stronger than ever. Why won't we accept the most plausible explanation? Today is the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 tragedy. 8 years ago, the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and other buildings were destroyed. There are more than 50 different conspiracy theories which can be examined by an internet search. The latest 9/11 theory is that 47-story Tower 7 housed a secret bunker from the 9/11 was orchestrated and that it was destroyed by a controlled explosion to bury the evidence. This is based on the Department of Defense, CIA and US Secret Service, all having officer here. Added to this, Floor 23 was in New York City, command center on standby for civil emergency, but it had already been evacuated. Some some people continue to believe the conspiracy in question was not organized by Al-Qaeda, but by CIA. Others believe that this is nonsense, untrue. There are also many conspiracy theories about other issues. 9 out of 10 people in the US think that John Kennedy was assassinated as a part of a conspiracy. Why do we believe in the unbelievable? There are a few main reasons. Firstly, our minds are capable of organizing the same input in very different ways and different interpretations. There are ingrained habits in our thinking style that predispose us towards seeing the world in particular ways, that encourage us to favor certain interpretation of events over others. Also, we see a gap in our understanding and feel it's this ambiguity rather than a trusted account. The Greek philosopher Epictetus remarked, "Men are disturbed not by the things, but by the view that they take of them."
Marina, thanks very much. And we'll be having a little look at some of the conspiracy facts around 9/11 before the end of the programme. But Martin, I'd just like to bring you in to maybe to bring shed a bit of light on the Moscow apartment bombings. Can you tell us what your view of the significance of this event, which took place 2 years before 9/11? How has it affected the war on terror?
Well, the war on terror, of course, didn't exist at that stage. That was only invented after 9/11. You could say that a prototype for it was already running in Russia before 9/11, if you like. What was very important, as Marina pointed out, about the bombings in Moscow in September 1999, 10 years ago this week, was the timing, because a presidential election was due in November in Russia. It looked very likely that the former communists were going to win that election. They were certainly ahead in the opinion polls. And this was because of the collapse of the ruble in 1998 and the feeling in Russia that that the economic reform was failing. Powerful forces within Russia were not happy about the idea of a change of direction in the economic reform, to put it mildly. And they also had support in the West. So there was a strong motivation by such elements to create some kind of incident which would prevent the communists from winning that election in the November, which would have been a perfectly normal thing. All other East European countries, virtually all of them, had elected the communists, often in the second election, free election, because of the pain of market reform. So this would have just been Russia being the same as virtually all the other countries. But of course it wasn't acceptable to the powerful oligarchs in Russia, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers. And I think that's the essential background to understanding the timing of the bombs in Moscow.
So what are the various versions of who was behind planting the bombs, of what happened? Well, the most credible ones?
Marina covered it from both angles there. I mean, the obvious, the straightforward one is the Chechens did it. Putin acted decisively, invaded Chechnya when Yeltsin was the president, Putin was the prime minister, invaded Chechnya, and then Putin went on to win the presidential election on the back of his strong stance. Of course, the second Chechen, because of course Chechen was already independent by this stage. Yeah, there was no motivation for the Chechens to bomb Moscow because they'd already won their independence. I mean, they were effectively outside the Russian Federation, so that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And of course we've subsequently had the revelations of Alexander Litvinenko, the chap who was poisoned with polonium, his book Blowing Up Russia. You can check it on the internet, anybody can see this. He basically says, I was an FSB agent, that is to say a Secret Service agent, we were involved in blowing up these buildings. Berezovsky, Boris Berezovsky, Putin's political opponent, who has a political asylum here in Britain, he says the same thing, that Putin was behind the bombings. George Soros has said the same thing, who is a Western currency speculator. So I think people are more willing to say that Putin was behind the Moscow bombs than they are willing to say that the US Secret Services were behind 9/11, although I noticed that Marina did cover that as well. I think whether one believes one theory or another does very much depend upon your worldview and what you previously knew or know about the way the world works.
One of the things I find quite intriguing is this link with this Alexander Litvinenko and the weird kind of polonium poisoning, his death, I think it was 2 years ago in 2007, I believe, or maybe the end of 2006 in London. I mean, who can you just give us an idea of who was Alexander Litvinenko?
Well, Litvinenko was an FSB officer. That is to say, he was a secret service officer in Russia.
That was the replacement for the KGB.
The replacement for the KGB. Yeah. And in his book, Blowing Up Russia, he explains how the KGB, if you like, institutionally survived the fall of the Soviet Union by breaking itself up into lots of different organisations called different things. So it was no longer the monolithic KGB, it was now all of these different things, with the FSB as a kind of umbrella body for the pre-existing structures. And these structures mutated under the influence of capitalist reform into capitalist secret service terror networks, the same as we have in the West. Some people listening may say you can't say things like that, but what I say to them is the way you look at the world depends upon where you look at it from. People in Russia, just like people in the United States, tend to believe the government if they are the kind of people that tend to believe the government. Those who are closer to the action often have a much sharper understanding of what goes on. And I put it to people listening in their cars as they're driving home this evening, if it's possible for the FSB to kill its own people, to start a war in order to fix an election so that privatisation and can be carried through in the interests of certain groups, why is it incredible to suggest the same of Western intelligence services and their acolytes? I think the fact of the matter is that they're all capable of doing these things. We discussed Lockerbie last week. It clearly was not the Libyans that did Lockerbie, to all intelligent people who look at the evidence. So people really must learn to withhold judgment when events like this happen. And that includes conspiracy theorists. We shouldn't presume that we know anything about an event until we've analysed what's actually happened. And there are various possible explanations for most events.
Well, what about the involvement of the Russian oligarch Boris Berezovsky? First of all, are there lots of different Russian oligarchs? What is Berezovsky doing now in London? Because he used to be one of the closest allies of Vladimir Putin during Putin's rise to power.
Berezovsky is an interesting character because he says that Putin was involved in plotting this effectively a coup by bombing, because he helped him to do it. I mean, Berezovsky was one of the key oligarchs, and he was a kind of oligarch in chief, if you like. And he and Chubais and others were looking for somebody to rescue them from the communists who were going to win the election. Perhaps the communists would have done a deal with them. Who knows? But they weren't prepared to run the risk. And I think the fact that he's defected to the West now and is prepared to say that, yes, Putin was behind the bombs, I mean, either Putin's lying or Berezovsky's lying. Now, Putin is whoever he is. He's an intelligent man, but he may well have done it. Berezovsky is best friends with Dick Cheney and with the American right wing. And they presumably believe Berezovsky that Putin did it. Now, I think that what will come out in due course, this is September the 11th today, the anniversary of the attacks in New York, eventually either the Russian Secret Service will tell everything they know about 9/11 in order to embarrass the Americans, or the US Secret Services will tell everything they know about 999, which is what I call it, September 1999 in Moscow, in order to embarrass the Russians. If they could agree with each other to keep quiet, which they have done so far, then the mass of the population will probably remain quiescent. But eventually these things will come out, and I think it will be decisive when they do.
Thanks very much, Martin, and thanks, Marina, for your report on the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings. Well, it's September the 11th today, and we're having a look now at a book called Secrets and Lies. The author is David Southwell, and he has a very interesting item. This book is what he calls conspiracy fact about September the 11th. In fact, he has entries for all sorts of interesting events through the most recent history. And on September the 11th, he says, 2009, this is the 8th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. That's today. And I'm bringing you just a small part of the benefit of hindsight the 8 years have given us since the original 9/11. The following extract is from a book about conspiracy facts.
For people to be able to judge truth from lies on an objective basis, they need to have access to the facts. If you get anything less than that during an official investigation of a subject, any findings it makes will never amount to more than a whitewash that robs the public of their chance to determine what really happened. When the issues that people want to know the truth about are the events that occurred in the months leading up to the 9/11 attacks, you would think the White House would bend over backwards to ensure the American public was given a chance to make their own judgment by cooperating fully with the inquiry conducted by Congress. They didn't. After months of pressure, President Bush finally allowed the establishment of the 9/11 Commission, with Dr. Henry Kissinger at its head. When Kissinger refused to provide details of his business interests and clients, he was replaced as chairman by Thomas Keane. Naturally, the Commission was keen to interview the President to establish exactly what he and the White House staff knew about the Al-Qaeda threat in advance of the attacks. Both President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney refused to appear in public before the Commission. It took several months of behind-the-scenes negotiations before Bush and Cheney would agree to meet the commissioners, and even then it was only under the following extraordinary conditions. They would not be under oath, they could appear together, and the session would not be recorded, transcribed, or ever made public. Bush even refused to allow the families of those who had died access to the evidence that he and his vice president gave. After a three-hour visit by the commissioners, George W. Bush gave a short press conference in the White House Rose Garden. He said, "If we had something to hide, we wouldn't have met with them in the first place. If there was nothing to hide, why was what said kept secret? It's an important question to which the American people have yet to receive an answer." That was a look at the 9/11 Commission, the US government official investigation into the 9/11 attacks, from a 2005 book about conspiracy facts by author David Southwell, entitled Secrets and Lies. St John's Church is part of Bristol's old city walls, the junction of Broad Street and Nelson Street. Since medieval times, St John's Conduit has been bringing fresh water under Bristol streets to a public fountain in Nelson Street, just by St John's, from a hidden spring close to what's now the Boston Tea Party at the top of Park Street. But since last year, Wessex Water's sewage works in Frogmore Street, the water fountain by St John's Church has run dry for the first time in 700 years. So what is a conduit? Well, it's a tunnel which you have to stoop to walk through. It runs just under street level and allows access to maintain and repair medieval lead or wooden water pipe. In Exeter city centre, for example, for a modest sum, you can actually take a tour through the old city conduits from Easter through to October. None of Bristol's, though, are open to the public. Commissioned by Carmelite friars in 1267, St John's Conduit has been carefully looked after by the monks, then the church and the city over the centuries. And I've been finding more about the pipe's history. Known locally as St John's Conduit, it is more correctly referred to as the Carmelite Pipe. It was named after the White Friars who in 1267, that's nearly 750 years ago, took the water from the spring on the slopes of Brandon Hill, the top of Park Street, to their priory in Colston Street, the site of the present-day Colston Hall. With Henry VIII's dissolution of the monasteries, the water supply reverted to the parish and the city. During the Blitz of the last war, St John's provided the only source of potable water for city centre residents. Full details of this very complex system are contained in the Temple Local History Group publication entitled Account of the St John's Conduit, Bristol's Medieval Water System. The main problem with the recent drying up of this conduit seems to be identifying whose responsibility it is. Mark Thomas and Patrick Shannon were in charge of the Wessex Water Works last year. They say it's not their fault that they have restored the conduit to the same position it was before they started the works, and that someone else has interfered with the water supply further up the system while the works were taking place. That's those works in Frogmore Street last year. Vicky O'Loughlin and Pete Wood at Bristol City Council Press Office say they don't know whose responsibility the conduits are, despite their Highways Department being responsible for the manholes and other access covers. Anne Harvey at Southwest Church's Conservation Trust, who look after St John's, is concerned too. She tells me St John's Church itself too has had no water supply since the Wessex Water Works. Nigel Sherritt, office manager at Church House in Great George Street, home of the Bristol Diocese of the Church of England, has been making inquiries yesterday and today. He has discovered that Bristol City Council does indeed have a property ID reference number for St John's Conduit and, quote, a maintenance obligation on the conduit, unquote. As to what happened to the St John's Conduit water, the investigation continues. If anybody knows anything or can suggest further lines of inquiry, please do email me at tony@bcfm.com. www.somaliapeople.org.uk, and I'll be bringing you further reports on the ongoing mystery of who or what is blocking St John's Conduit as we find out more. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up very soon, it's the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol and around the world. And we have done that a little bit less this week because we've been concentrating on Somalia. If you want the story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic for, or a guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guests, Mukhtar Abdi and Abdi Mohammed. They're from Bristol's Somali Voice newspaper, and our resident Old Labour pundit and economics expert, Martin Summers. The Moscow apartment bombings report was courtesy of Marina Morris. Next week we'll have Stephen Williams in the studio. He's the Lib Dem MP for West Bristol, Bristol West even. And you can hear previous week's shows and find out what's going on to be on next week by going to bcfm.org.uk and clicking on the presenters' shows. On the right to find the Friday Drive Time page. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.